The people of Morocco are putting increasing pressure on their government to cut ties with Israel.
I wish to stop this fire. We are like family.
But stopping the fire is complicated. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, shocking new information about packages intended to burst into flames on airplanes.
This thing can burn underwater. It can burn without oxygen. So it's very simple and very clever.
And in the Philippines, divorce is illegal. There's also a taboo around it.
Sometimes they said to us that we are evil.
The move to change that.
Plus, the heady magic of a marathon course.
There is no other sport that you are standing on exactly the same start line as the gods of the sport. You know, you can't play on the center court of Wimbledon.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We're giving you a break from the U.S. election this hour. We will have global reaction on tomorrow's show. Today, a lot of other news is happening around the world.
We begin with new revelations about parcels that burst into flames in a German DHL facility over the summer. The Wall Street Journal reports the devices were part of a Russian plot against Washington and its allies. Bojan Panchevsky is the Wall Street Journal's chief European political correspondent in Berlin.
The plan was very simple. They wanted to ship a bunch of parcels containing incendiary devices from countries in Eastern Europe. And the addresses were all in Britain, Canada, and the United States. The idea was to ship these parcels using global shipping companies such as DHL, but also others. And the parcels were supposed to go alight while in transit, meaning also on airplanes, including airplanes that would be crossing the Atlantic. And investigators essentially said that in a case like that, it could have come to a catastrophe because a fire on board an airplane like that is extremely difficult to extinguish when you're flying over the ocean. And these parcels were rigged in a way that they make fire that cannot be basically extinguished with the onboard firefighting equipment that exists at this stage.
Right. I understand that has something to do with magnesium in some of the components that were being shipped.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a magnesium mixture. You have to think of these magnesium flares that people sometimes use at sports events or the police is sometimes using them on the roads. In the olden days, in the 60s, even divers were using them underwater when they didn't have kind of flashlights. This thing can burn underwater. It can burn without oxygen. So it's very simple and very clever. And that's how it was explained to me by German investigators who kind of broke down the thing and recreated it in a forensic lab. And then they tested it in various circumstances to see how it would behave in a kind of airplane environment.
What level of concern have security officials in Europe expressed about Russia had been planning and what Russia's intent was?
Well, they've said that Russia's intent was, is, and has been throughout the course of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine to sow panic in the West, to kind of destabilize Western societies, especially NATO countries. It has been part of a kind of a much broader campaign of sabotage and clandestine operation that has been unfolding on European soil. Cables have been cut, railway cables, data cables, underwater pipelines. So all sorts of things have been happening. But this thing is, I think, until now, the kind of gravest case of escalation in that sense, because it could have basically led to a mass casualty situation.
Mm. Russia has denied responsibility for all of this. That is not surprising. I'm curious, though, how solid is the evidence that Russia is behind this, both the evidence that Western intelligence has offered and what you at The Wall Street Journal were able to find out?
Well, we're not really able to assess the evidence. Much of it or most of it is classified and highly classified because it's obtained by intelligence sources. We don't even know if it's signal intelligence or human intelligence, but you know, they are saying that they are very confident that Russia is behind this plot. But obviously, as ever, they're not really making the evidence public. And they didn't really want the story to be public as well. I mean, we had to do a lot of digging. Because I think one of the objectives, or perhaps the key objective of the Russians in doing this, allegedly at least, is to create uncertainty and panic. A lot of officials that talked to me off the record about this story were sort of frustrated that there is silence around this issue. I mean, they three, four of them said that they believe this should come out in the open in order to kind of A, put an end to it, and B, prepare society for what's happening.
That's the Wall Street Journal's Boyan Panchevsky.
Many nations around the world are protesting Israel's actions in Gaza, especially Israel's neighbors in the Arab world. The approach Morocco has taken has been cautious and measured. The two nations have strengthened trade and security ties since they normalized relations in 2020. Lately, though, Morocco's government is under pressure from its own people to cut those ties. The World's Jerry Hadden reports from Morocco's capital, Rabat.
The balance Morocco's trying to strike, condemning the Israeli government without jeopardizing bilateral relations, many ordinary Moroccans, like 35-year-old spice vendor Soufiette Mansour, seem to get it. Mansour owns a shop in a narrow alley inside Rabat's Medina, or Old Quarter. He says everyone here condemns Israel's killing of tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians over the last year.
What they do, we are not with them. If they kill people, they kill children, and this, I'm not okay with this.
And yet?
I don't want Morocco cut with Israel, because, you know, a lot of Moroccan people, they live in Israel, so we are like family.
Mansour is referring to the nearly 500,000 Jews of Moroccan descent in Israel. Most emigrated there after the State of Israel was created in 1948. Morocco has tried to highlight those ties since recognizing the Jewish state 4 years ago, as well as the two countries' growing links in trade and tourism. But 1 year after the Hamas attacks on Israel and the subsequent war in Gaza, that messaging has lost its resonance. Last month, protesters across Morocco held anti-Israel marches. Here in Rabat, hundreds of thousands of people showed up, calling for an end to relations with Tel Aviv. The huge number of Moroccans who protested in Rabat came from all walks of life, says Ahmed Wihman. They were Islamists, leftists, patriots, nationalists, and political independents. Wichman is head of the Moroccan Association Against Normalization with Israel, an umbrella group. He says all these groups have the same goal, to cut ties with what he calls the Zionist colonizer and committer of genocide. It's not a question of anti-Semitism, he says. It's barbarism versus humanism. As for the Hamas attacks in Israel that killed more than 1,100 people, Wichman says he's against violence aimed at civilians, but he insists, as do many throughout the Arab world, that October 7th was a reaction to decades of Israeli oppression. Back at the Medina, another shop owner, 19-year-old Abdel Hadin, agrees. Hadin says, I missed the recent protest because I had to work. But, he says, I really want to go directly to the war itself to support my Palestinian brothers.
In the war? You want to go?
Yes. I want to go to Palestine.
Without a doubt, sentiment has turned sharply against Israel over the last year, says Intisar Fakir. She's a researcher with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. But Fakir says that by normalizing ties with Israel, Morocco gained a long-sought concession, recognition of its sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara.
A deal happened not only because the king himself and his advisors wanted it to happen, but also because publicly it was tied to the question of the Western Sahara.
This recognition is not something Morocco wants to put at risk, says Fakir, especially because the U.S. is on board.
And no matter what kind of government you are, you cannot stand in any kind of deal that would give you the long-sought U.S. recognition of your sovereignty claims over this territory.
Morocco and the independence-minded Polisario Front, backed by Algeria, have been disputing control of the area for decades, and the U.S. has vested interests in keeping Morocco happy. The two countries work closely together against terrorist groups in the Sahel region to Morocco's south. In what Fakir calls a triangular geopolitical alliance, Israel's also involved in improving Morocco's security. It sells Rabat millions of dollars in military hardware and technology each year.
Morocco sort of has its own ambition of becoming itself a supplier and provider of some military technology to other countries.
Another factor that will likely keep Morocco from cutting ties to Israel, So far, despite the collective outcry, no other Arab nation that recognizes Israel, among them Egypt, Jordan, and Bahrain, has broken off relations. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Rabat, Morocco.
News from Israel this afternoon. The Israeli defense minister is out. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired Yoav Gallant today in a surprise announcement. The two have been at odds throughout the war in Gaza. We will have more on the political scandals swirling around Netanyahu tomorrow on The World.
26.2 miles. Running a marathon is an accomplishment no matter where you do it, but there is a special series of marathons known as the majors that hold extra prestige. It is a short list: Boston, New York, Chicago, London, Berlin, and Tokyo. And now Sydney, Australia has joined their ranks. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The World Marathon Majors are sponsored by Abbott, the healthcare company, and they represent the biggest, most prestigious marathons in the world. Professionals seek out the races for massive paydays and career milestones, while amateurs sign up to complete the series and collect all 6 stars. Well, now 7 stars.
To have an Abbott World Marathon Major in Australasia, you know, this is about expanding marathon running and the community of marathon running around the world.
Hugh Brasher heads up the London Marathon. He says Sydney is the first addition to the majors since 2013, when Tokyo joined. Since then, the number of people running marathons has exploded.
3, 2, 1. And we are away in the TCS Sydney Marathon for 2024.
In Sydney's race alone, participation increased by 400% from 2022 to 2024. It's expected to rise another 30% next year and will attract high-profile professionals. That, Brasher says, is one of the draws for everyday runners.
There is no other sport that you are standing on exactly the same start line as the gods of the sport. You know, you can't play on the centre court of Wimbledon. You can't go around the Sao Paulo racetrack at the same time as Max Verstappen.
Exactly how Sydney became a major is a bit unclear. In an email, Abbott World Marathon Majors told me they don't share the full list of criteria publicly, but races are judged on over 100 metrics, from runner experience to course signage to aid stations. On TikTok, many runners are thrilled with the news.
The most exciting news coming out of Sydney today.
I don't know about anyone else, but I'm gassed. I've always wanted to go to Australia. Hopefully I can get a place.
Sydney Marathon se acaba de convertir en la séptima World Marathon Major.
Before this week, the closest major marathon for Australians was Tokyo. Not everyone is happy, though.
6 was enough. So this crazy challenge I've set myself is now harder, going to take much longer to do, and way more expensive.
Australia is far away from a lot of places, and some runners fear their dream of finishing all the majors will continue to get less realistic. But Hugh Brasher from the London Marathon says achieving more geographic diversity is important for the series.
There absolutely will be a limit, but I also think that surely Africa, surely China, there should be a major in those countries.
Cape Town and Shanghai are currently candidates to join the majors, by the way. But for now, the focus is on Sydney. And New South Wales Minister for Jobs and Tourism, John Graham, sees dollar signs.
This is a big economic boost to the state, $300 million over the course of a decade.
The precedent is there. Other majors regularly bring in hundreds of millions of dollars per race, and Chicago's 2023 marathon brought in a record $547 million. That's from runners and all the people who come along with them. Here's Brasher again.
We know that the average person running the London Marathon brings 5.4 people with them.
And who knows what other legacies the newly minted race will leave, because the Sydney Marathon itself is the product of another major sporting event, the 2000 Summer Olympics.
Seconds, but here we are, ready for a start.
They're away. Away with
the race was first held as a test event before the Games. It was so successful that it's continued ever since, with some changes to the course over the years. But athletes still see the sights, crossing the Sydney Harbour Bridge and ending at the Opera House. Next year's race, the first as a major, is scheduled for August 31st. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco Werman here. Democracy is at the top of our minds this month, with a number of countries holding national and regional elections, including the United States. Here at The World, we believe strongly that human-centered journalism is at the heart of an informed public and a strong democracy. We see democracy and journalism as two sides of the same coin. And if you care about one, it is imperative to care about the other. Every day, our nonprofit newsroom goes beyond breaking news to share human insights from the people living the stories that make headlines. This personalized approach, reporting on the ground and prioritizing the voices of real people, does not come cheap. It takes time and energy to find those guests with those experiences and is only possible because of the support of listeners like you. So as we kick off our fall fundraiser, I'm asking for your support of this critical work. From now until the end of the year, we are striving to raise $67,000, and we need your help to get there. Please go to theworld.org/give or visit the link in our episode notes to give today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for believing in journalism that strengthens our democracy.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Armenian Christians in the old city of Jerusalem say their future there is under threat. They're a small minority in the historic area, but have had a visible presence for centuries. And now the Armenian Christian community is worried that a contentious real estate deal could uproot them from a place that's central to their identity. The World's Matthew Bell brings us the story from Jerusalem.
Entering the Cathedral of St. James is like walking into the Middle Ages. The stunningly decorated church is named after two Christian martyrs, both of them named James, one the brother of Jesus, the other the Apostle James, who was beheaded by King Herod almost 2,000 years ago. His severed head is believed to be buried here under the church. These seminary students from Armenia, young men in long black robes, are part of a Christian tradition that goes back to the Crusades. Most of the cathedral dates from the 12th century, but parts of it are much older. Armenia, about 800 miles away from Jerusalem, was the very first nation to convert to Christianity. St. James Cathedral is the religious center of the Armenian quarter in Jerusalem's Old City. Across the street from the church is a parking lot, but like many locations in this part of the world, it's much more than just a parking lot.
This entire area is called the Historical Armenian Garden.
Hagop Jarnazian is a community activist who grew up here in Jerusalem. He points to the ancient walls of the old city, the seminary, several residential homes, including the home of the Armenian Patriarch, who's the head of the Armenian Apostolic Church.
The Armenian presence in Jerusalem dates back to the 4th century. And this plot of land that we are standing in is under the ownership of the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem for more than 700 years.
And this is the heart of the controversy. The Patriarch signed a deal to sell a big piece of this area to a Jewish businessman. That deal was done in secret in 2021. When the details became public last year, people were not happy about it.
So the community, and not only the community, local Christian leaders, international Armenian leaders, organizations and communities pressured on the Patriarchate to cancel the deal. And we succeeded.
Late last year, the Patriarch tried to get out of the real estate deal. He said he was misled and blamed his own real estate advisor, an Armenian priest himself, who's since been defrocked and fled to the U.S., The Patriarch said the agreement to sell the parking lot and surrounding area should be nullified, but the buyers refused to back down. Soon after the Patriarch denounced the real estate deal, a group of Jewish men with guns and dogs showed up in the parking lot to confront local Armenians. They had come out to stop a bulldozer used to dig up some of the parking lot and knock down a stone wall. That was about a year ago. Since then, the situation has remained in a stalemate of sorts. There's an ongoing legal battle in Israeli courts. And in the meantime, Hagop Jarnazian, along with a group of Armenian activists, is staying here in shifts to protect the area from demolition.
members of the community are staying here 24/7. For example, today is my seventh day staying here, sleeping here in the car outside, just to protect the land from illegal constructions of the company and provocations from the company.
This particular property that's at stake right now is fundamental to the ability of Armenian Christians to live as Armenian Christians in the old city of Jerusalem.
Karnig Kerkonian is an American attorney and part of the legal team representing Jerusalem's Armenian community in Israeli court. One part of their argument in this case, which they hope will terminate that 2021 real estate deal, is based on a centuries-old document from the days when the Ottoman Empire controlled this holy city.
What we have is a trust that was created in the late 1500s by an Armenian priest, which essentially bequeathed this property to his issue, his descendants, and if there are no other descendants, then to the Armenian community. And those are the words that are used in the trust, with the church being the trustee, if you will.
Kerkonian says this shows that the Armenian patriarch didn't have the authority to be selling off land. And he points out that Ottoman-era documents have been used successfully in Israeli courts before. Usually this involves Jewish Israelis claiming ownership over property inhabited by Palestinians. Beyond the legal strategy, though, Kerkonian says this dispute is about maintaining the unique religious diversity in one of the holiest places on earth.
I mean, this is what Jerusalem stands for, particularly given the fact that we, our tax dollars, invest so much money into the region to try to preserve some sort of peaceful coexistence in a region that is, quite frankly, inflamed right now.
The company trying to buy the land in the heart of the Armenian quarter is called Zana Gardens. Kerkonian says it was founded in 2021, right after the now disputed real estate deal was signed. A lawyer for Zana Gardens told me his client would not allow him to speak with me for this story. The company is allegedly connected to far-right Jewish activists who've been trying to help Israeli Jews buy properties in East Jerusalem. That's where most of the city's Muslims and Christians live. REA King has been active with this kind of effort. He's also the deputy mayor of Jerusalem. He told me that Zana Gardens asked him to get involved in the legal case, but he says he refused.
I say no, because I'm not sure about the legit of the deal, and my name is important for me. So I preferred not to be involved.
King says this dispute needs to be settled by the courts, not by politicians and not the municipal government. And in any case, as he sees it, the fears expressed by Armenians about being driven out of Jerusalem are overblown. Armenian Christians living in Israel, King says, are safer than those in other parts of the Middle East. But this is a population that's small and getting smaller. A census from 2006 found fewer than 1,000 Armenians living in the Armenian quarter. Jerusalem City Council member Laura Wharton told me she's suspicious of this real estate deal and that she worries it's all part of the Israeli far right's goal to push non-Jews out of Jerusalem. But she also says she's confident that the Armenians will win their court case and be able to hold on to that highly valued piece of property in the old city.
There is an Israeli law about protecting the holy places, and it explicitly says that Israel is and will be responsible for protecting the holy sites of all religions and protecting freedom of religion and the dignity and rights of the different peoples and the different religions. And I think most Israelis are, an overwhelming majority are supportive of that.
Back in the parking lot, Armenian activists say they're not going anywhere until their legal battle is settled. Using some of the rubble created by that bulldozer, they built a barrier across part of the lot, along with a makeshift shelter to sleep in at night and welcome visitors during the day. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Jerusalem.
More global news is still coming your way this hour, including the fight to legalize divorce in the Philippines. You're listening to The World.
On the front lines in Ukraine, another wartime winter begins.
It's like, let's do the job. We need to get it done.
Plus, two brothers on bicycles get lost in Burkina Faso, and it's a beautiful thing.
That one magical afternoon stands out in our memory.
That's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Snow fell this week in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, where power outages are frequent and residential heating systems unreliable. Meanwhile, on the front line, Ukrainian troops are bracing for what's likely to be their hardest winter since the start of the conflict. One Ukrainian commander says the current Russian offensive is one of the war's most powerful yet. Andriy Shadrin has been talking with us periodically to give a soldier's perspective from the front line in eastern Ukraine. He's a 28-year-old sergeant. That's a new promotion. And when we caught up with him today in the Donetsk region, he'd just finished cooking a pot of borscht for his platoon.
It's like hot with a lot of meat, so it's kind of what you need in cold, late autumn night.
Sticks to your ribs, as we say here.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It is very good to talk to you again. How are you doing?
Well, we're still able to conduct missions as usual, but the whole strategic situation kind of sucks, frankly speaking.
When you and I talked last in July, you described Russian soldiers kind of inching forward to capture territory. What has happened since then? Has that pace changed?
Tactics appear to be pretty effective. They just don't turn the meat grinder off.
They don't turn the meat grinder off?
Yeah. They just spend waves of people and armed vehicles forward. And from 1 to 3 assaults out of 10, the Ukrainian infantry is unable to stop them, so they capture a couple of square kilometers of Ukrainian soil.
And what's behind this loss of momentum on the Ukrainian side from your perspective? Is it largely because you're outnumbered, or is it shortages of ammo and equipment, which we've talked about before?
Well, it's both of them. You can never get enough equipment, as I said, and for sure we're outnumbered.
So are Russian forces gaining territory every day?
In my operational zone, it's not like everyday losses of territory, but we still slowly retreat. And Russians are still able to operate with the same low-quality personnel. And their strategy and the way they conduct operation allows them to deal with the same low-quality personnel of lower ranks.
So in April, Ukraine lowered the draft age to 25, and we're hearing that Ukrainian officials have been rounding up young men on the streets or at bars or concerts and conscripting them. What is your perspective on that?
Well, for me as a guy who started serving and fighting in an actual war in being 18, I would prefer to see younger men in my platoon and under my command. It's easier for them to study. It's easier for them to learn something new. It's a shame when young people die and et cetera, but from a perspective of, you know, the question of national survivability, I would prefer to see younger men. We need to get it done. Let's do the job.
Let's do the job. We've heard that Russian troops are making greater use of gliding air bombs. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, one of my guys was injured by one of that gliding bombs. On a TV tower 60 meters up in the air, we had to pull him down with a rope.
Wow. How do they work?
Well, it's like the bomb ejects from the plane 10 to 15 kilometers far away from the front line and then flies to the aim on its own.
Okay.
So without being brought by a jet.
How accurate are they?
You don't need to be accurate when you throw half of ton of TNT on someone's head.
It's a massive bomb, and so you don't need to have pinpoint accuracy.
Yeah, it's like the whole Russian and Soviet doctrine of burned soil.
Ukrainian officials said this week for the first time that their troops fired at North Korean soldiers in combat. Those soldiers are being deployed by Russia in the Kursk region. Is that something that has been a topic of conversation among you and other soldiers?
Yeah, for sure. That's the most totalitarian regime in the world, maybe. And I'm pretty much sure they can send hundreds of thousands of people. You can give any amount of equipment, you can give any amount of money, any amount of whatever. Without boots on the ground, it will never work.
So how would you characterize morale right now? You're heading into another winter of fighting, some steady territorial losses to Russia. How is everyone feeling?
You know, we have no choice. I'm not sure it's like a high morale and neither low, for sure. But what are we going to do? Surrender and, like, what? End up in Russian captivity? That's not an option. And I don't want this to happen to me or to anyone of people at all.
We've been watching for a few months that Russian troops are advancing on the city of Pokrovsk. Why is that city important?
Well, it's one of three big cities Ukraine still controls in Donetsk region. And it also has plenty of factories and mines that produce coal necessary for our factories. They just got an opportunity to break the front line there.
Right. Russia took a village on the outskirts on Sunday.
Yeah, and they just got that opportunity to push forward pretty significantly for the last couple of months.
So that's a significant supply and logistics hub. What happens if that city falls?
Well, it's going to be a great loss for Ukrainian troops. It will also affect me and units in my operational zone. But I'm not sure it's going to be like the last fight and then we're going to surrender.
I remember your parents were born in Soviet Russia, if I'm recalling correctly. They moved to Crimea, yeah, where you were born. May I ask if you've heard from them lately?
No. They fully support what's going on. They pay taxes on which, like, bombs and bullets shot at me are bought.
So you know that they are supporting Russia in this war of aggression?
They did it from the very beginning, since 2014, when the war began.
Right.
And I have a cousin, and he serves in Russian Navy.
Wow. You have a first cousin who's serving in the Russian Navy. You don't know what's become of him.
The last news I got, he ended up the Naval Academy and got transferred to Black Sea Fleet. And they got some accidents. And I'm still operating. I'm pretty glad about it.
The fight continues for you. Sergeant Andriy Shadrin serves in a Ukrainian military unit that repairs and replaces equipment damaged on the war's front lines. He spoke with us from the eastern Ukrainian region of Donetsk. Thank you so much for speaking with us again. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you.
We will continue to follow the latest of the war in Ukraine here on The World.
The Philippines is the last country on Earth outside of Vatican City where divorce is still illegal. Much of the population across the island nation is staunchly Catholic, taught by clergy that divorce is anti-family and forbidden. A movement to legalize divorce in the Philippines is gaining traction, but it is still very new and controversial. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
AJ Alfafara knew marrying her boyfriend was a bad idea, but then she got pregnant, she was 26, and she thought, the shame will be worse than being married.
Because it's a stigma when you get pregnant and you are a solo mom. There's this bad outlook on those kind of women, so it's best to be married.
But it really wasn't best for her, she says. They weren't compatible. She made it about 8 years and then left him in 2012. And though they've been separated ever since, under current Philippine law, AJ Alfafara might be married to this man forever. Alfafara now heads the Divorce Pilipinas Coalition, a group pushing to legalize divorce. She can't figure out why total strangers get to tell her how to live her life.
It will not affect their beliefs or their situation.
The Philippines, a former American colony, is structured a lot like the U.S. It has an elected Congress and a president. Its constitution says church and state don't mix. But Catholic priests influence politicians and the voting public. And polls show at least half the population still wants to keep divorce illegal for the good of the country.
There is another player in this besides the individual who wants to get divorced, and that's the society itself.
Tim Laws is a campaigner for the Alliance for the Family Foundation Philippines, a group against abortion, gender nonconformity, and divorce. Laws argues that the Philippines is unique in preserving a traditional definition of marriage that, in many places, existed for more than 1,000 years, until the last century. He says divorce can bring a better life to some people, but on the grand scale, kids of divorce fare worse.
They're more likely to be in poverty, as are their mothers, more likely to spend time in prison. They actually die more than 4 years earlier than children who are raised in married families. Their life is shortened.
This debate is heating up in the Philippines, much of it coming down to a dispute over individual rights versus a vision of the collective moral good. A law to legalize divorce has cleared the Philippine House of Representatives and now awaits Senate approval. AJ Alfafara says if it passes, she'll finally be free. For now, she still needs her so-called husband's approval to do basic things.
If I want to purchase a property, he will have to know about it because his signature is needed.
Worse yet, she says, many Filipinos are still married to someone who has abused them. Tim Laws, the conservative campaigner, says no one is demanding women stay in homes with violent spouses. The remedy for that, he says, is legal separation, in which a couple is still married, but the state recognizes they are not together.
If someone's living a life of misery, that is the right thing to do, with reflection and deep thought on the subject.
Legally separated couples can have their own bank accounts, for example, but can never marry someone else. AJ Alfafara argues trapping Filipinos in terrible marriages, even if just on paper, is unethical. But the Family Values Camp sometimes says the same thing about her campaign.
Sometimes they said to us that we are evil, you know, saying that you guys just want to have divorce so that you can remarry in limited times.
Tim Laws says the legalized divorce movement is just misguided.
They're not out to do evil. They're out to do good. They're not really digesting the facts.
He does worry that eventually the Philippines will join the rest of the world in allowing divorce. If a majority of Filipino senators do prove willing to defy the church and allow divorce, AJ Alfafara says, get ready.
It's going to be like, floodgates. Maybe the first 2 years?
Lawmakers have to decide before May 2025. That's when the current draft bill expires. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
The search is on worldwide for climate-friendly crops. There is a perennial variety of wheat that's native to Ukraine, southern Russia, Turkey, and northern Iran, and it fits the bill. It's called kernza and actually came to the U.S. in the 1930s as forage, something for livestock to graze on in arid conditions. But it never really made its way into the human diet, so there's no market for it currently. Craft brewers, though, they see an opportunity in kernza. Eric Schmid brings us a story from St. Louis Public Radio.
The inside of Blue Jay Brewing Company's cozy taproom is packed on this recent weekday afternoon. Dozens of people enjoy glasses of the lager-style beers that are a specialty of this St. Louis brewery. On tap today is a fresh creation called New Roots, and it's a hit.
How do you like it?
It's good. It's easy to drink.
Full-bodied. It's very balanced.
I love it. It's delicious. But it's still nice and crushable, so...
That was Daryl Flessner, Greg Campbell, and Brian Schubert. Blue Jay's owner and brewer, Jason Thompson, is also pleased with how this experimental beer turned out.
It's got a little bit different mouthfeel, I think, than barley beers, for sure. And definitely earthy, almost nutty.
Thompson says a quarter of the grain he used for this beer is kernza.
The kernel of this is much smaller than a barley kernel or a wheat kernel. Kind of elongated and skinny, almost flat.
And that led to a small issue in making the beer. Thompson says the kernza slipped right through his mill when he tried to crush the kernels and expose the starch that's necessary for brewing. In the end, Thompson just used a different brewing technique. He says he loves the challenge that comes with working with a grain he's never used before. And kernza is relatively new. The grain first hit the market in 2018. It comes from a plant that's been used as forage in the U.S. for around a century. Roughly 40 years ago, researchers started breeding it to become a commodity. They wanted higher yields and grains that are easier to mill. Allison Miller is an evolutionary biologist who researches the plant at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis.
Kernza is essentially a 10,000-year disadvantage.
This is a recently identified potential crop that's been in development for decades, not centuries or millennia.
Miller says it's an appealing crop that can both feed people and improve the environment. By staying in the ground year-round, it builds a deep root system that absorbs water and nutrients, sequesters carbon, and builds new soil, among other benefits. But right now, Kernza is grown on just under 2,500 acres, out of the hundreds of millions farmed across the country.
This is not something that we could go this fall and say, you know, next year I'd really like to shift this soybean field to Kernza. That's going to be a challenge at the scale of contemporary agriculture.
The environmental benefits alone may not be enough for farmers or consumers to switch, but the Land Institute's Tessa Peters says there is a business case.
I think that's where Kernza really has an edge, because it actually tastes great and makes delicious products.
Peter's organization develops many perennial crops, including Kernza. She says the market for it right now is soft and unpredictable. But Peters says all of that could easily change if a large food conglomerate like General Mills or Nestle committed to using a tiny amount of Kernza in some of their most popular products.
A few big companies who put 1% to 5% of Kernza in their best-selling products could translate to tens or hundreds of thousands of acres.
She says if larger companies take up the grain, milling and processing facilities would follow. That could make it easier for more businesses and people to access the grain. People like Blue Jay Brewing's Thompson, who had to know a guy who knew a guy to just get his hands on the Kernza he needed for his beer.
Are you going to make it again?
It depends on the availability of Kernza. But yeah, I would like to.
He says he can see this beer staying on tap year-round. But for now, he'll have to stick to brewing with barley and wheat. That's just easier to get. For The World, I'm Eric Schmid in St. Louis.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Our next story takes us to the West African nation of Burkina Faso with Andy Davis of New Hampshire and his identical twin. Davis admits that he and his twin are polar opposites. What they share, though, are the wise words a stranger offered them on this journey. Davis told the story on GBH's Stories from the Stage.
My brother and I are standing on a dusty path in the heart of West Africa, watching the sun sink toward the horizon, and we're absolutely befuddled as to which way to go. We hold our bicycles by the handlebars and look back and forth. And it occurs to me that it's not unusual for me myself to get myself in a bind by improvising, but my brother usually starts with a clear, well-thought-out plan. Did I mention that we're identical twins? When people hear that, they often ask, how identical are you? Well, the answer is, in ways that are obvious and superficial, pretty darn identical. But he's the type A twin. When we were babies, I was content to crawl along on my belly indefinitely while he came out with a clearly thought-out workout plan so he could learn to walk as quickly as possible. When we shared a room, he folded his underwear while I dumped my clothes out on the floor so I could find things more easily. When we ran our first marathon together, he came in under our goal time while I under-trained and brought up the rear. He has enough advanced degrees for both of us. But when it comes to our view of the world, what we hold sacred, our hopes for the planet, we're gloriously alike. And we've always looked for opportunities in our adult lives to get together and have experiences which would become reference points in our common culture, which is how I happened to be visiting him at the tail end of his stint in the Peace Corps in Burkina Faso. And of all the time we spent together on that trip, that one magical afternoon stands out in our common memory. After he was done his work day at the high school in Kudugu, we hopped on bicycles and pedaled north, out of town, past the big Catholic church, past herds of sheep and goats who were nibbling the green grass that had popped up after the first rains a few days before. And a couple of kilometers out, we took a right between two spreading baobab trees and continued to zigzag down the path across the savanna grasslands, past mud-walled family compounds, past farmers in conical hats working the soil with broad hoes, preparing for planting in the next few days. And that afternoon took on the timelessness of childhood. But it was a timelessness of childhood with the additional factor of alcoholic beverages. Because each hamlet we passed through, some generous soul would wave us in under a thatched roof to enjoy a calabash of Dolo, homemade millet beer. And after several such visits, we noticed that the sun was getting alarmingly close to setting and the timelessness evaporated, because we realized with all those calabashes of liquid hospitality and all the turns we had taken on our bicycles, we had no idea how to get back to my brother's house in Kudugu. So at the edge of the next village, we asked if there was a French speaker nearby, and we were led to the house of the chef du village, sort of a mayor. We were welcomed into the relative cool of the living room, and we sat down around a long, low table. They offered us tea. We were relieved it wasn't millet beer. And then as we began to sip, they asked us questions about where we were from. The United States, was it a neighboring country to France? It's important that you understand that these were men who had built their own houses, grew all their own food under challenging circumstances, raised their own livestock, lived in a complex cosmology that connected them to the ancestors and those around them and those to come. They just didn't know international geography. It also bears pointing out that it was my brother and I who were lost. They knew exactly where they were. So my brother crouched down next to the table and began to move the metal teapot and the glass teacups to give a sense of scale. He said, "Here we are, and if you cross the Sahel and cross the Sahara, you'll get to the edge of the Mediterranean." Now he gestured across the table. "If you cross the Mediterranean, you get to France, and then hang a left and travel twice as far as you've already traveled, you get to where we live in the United States." The two men smiled and shook their heads in confusion. And then the chef du village said, so softly we could barely hear, "Que Dieu est grand." God is great. Well, a few days later, I traveled home by the route my brother had sketched out. But that simple phrase has stayed with both of us across all the long years since. Que Dieu est grand. God is great. No matter how many times we've heard similar words come from the mouths of true believers of all stripes with dangerous certainty, we remember that humble expression of awe at the grandeur of creation. And for us, it's like a talisman against human arrogance. And now, when my brother and I get together on a mountaintop or in a canoe at dawn as the first rays of sunlight are cutting through the mist, one of us is bound to turn to the other and whisper, "Que Dieu est grand." And our smiles are identical.
Andy Davis on Stories from the Stage from our GBH partners at worldchannel.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We are back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.